From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, co-writing and directing Old School, Starsky and Hutch, and the new comedy School for Scoundrels, we talk with Todd Phillips. He's directed such actors as Vince Vaughn, Will Ferrell, Ben Stiller, and Owen and Luke Wilson. His new movie stars Billy Bob Thornton as a con man who runs a self-help school for losers. The chief loser is played by John Heder, the star of Napoleon Dynamite. Also, rock historian Ed Ward goes back to the late 70s to profile the art rock band Wire. And John Powers reviews a film he loved at the Cannes Film Festival. Now it's out on DVD, and you can see it too. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Todd Phillips has directed some of the great comic actors of his generation, like Will Ferrell, Vince Vaughn, Ben Stiller, and Owen and Luke Wilson. Phillips co-wrote and directed the movies Starsky and Hutch, a tribute to the 70s cop series, and Old School, about three guys in their 30s who are resisting the commitments of adulthood by starting a college fraternity. Phillips' first feature film was Road Trip. Before that, he made two documentaries, one about fraternity hazing rituals, the other about punk rock. Phillips' new film, School for Scoundrels, stars Billy Bob Thornton and John Heder, who became famous as the lead in Napoleon Dynamite. Heder plays a timid loser who enrolls in a self-help class taught by a con man played by Thornton. After each student pays Thornton $5,000 to enroll, he promises to teach them how to be aggressive and get what they want. He forces them to initiate confrontations with strangers, warns them that friends are just obstacles that stand in the way of success, and he takes the students to the woods so that they can shoot at each other with paintball guns.
Now, in those bags are 15 semi-automatic, high-powered paintball guns. It is time to kill or be killed.
It says here to maintain a minimum distance of 100 feet between shooter and target, though.
Oh, my God!
Now, does anybody else want to read their gun?
You say you wrote the part for Billy Bob Thornton. I think he's really terrific, and one of the things I love about him is he's so great at playing dissolute and at having this kind of incredible confidence that he shouldn't have, that he doesn't deserve
right.
to have. What did you see in him as a director that you wanted to, and as a writer that you wanted to work with?
The thing about Billy is I worked with a lot of, you know, funny actors before, but I haven't worked with somebody with Billy's kind of acting ability before. I mean, he really is, you know, at the top of his game as an actor. So for us, it was just, you know, that. I mean, it was just Billy Bob. But you're right, he brings with him a confidence and a swagger because in real life, Billy's the real deal. You know, he has proven to us many times that he can get the girl, you know. So I think that Billy is the only logical choice for the part anyway.
The movie's in part a satire of, like, self-help culture. Did you immerse yourself in self-help books or self-help inspirational classes?
No, I didn't take any classes, but we did read the books. And you know, it is a little bit of a statement on sort of the American male and their need. What is this? Why do we turn to Dr. Phil? And why do we turn to books like called Shake Your Shyness? And where is this sort of, you know, why can't we find this from within in a way, you know? And I didn't necessarily immerse ourselves in it. And I say we. I wrote the film with my writing partner, Scott Armstrong. But we didn't necessarily immerse ourselves in it, but we read a little bit about it. And we certainly were trying to make the anti-doctor. Billy really represents sort of an anti-Dr. Phil in that way.
The anti-sensitive guy.
Yeah, the anti-sensitive guy, the anti-intelligent approach, maybe.
Now, you've worked with great comedic actors in your movies. I mean, like, you know, Vince Vaughn, who's just a terrific actor in general, but I think he's particularly swell in comedies. And, you know, Luke Wilson, Owen Wilson, Will Ferrell. How did you have enough power early on to work with people who had more of a track record than you did?
Well, actually, I think I got lucky with I had made my first film, Road Trip, which ended up doing very well. And when we wrote Old School, again, we wrote that film with Vince Vaughn in mind. And Vince and Will Ferrell weren't where they are now. And I'm not saying they didn't have a better track record than I did at the time. But they were really just, Vince was coming off of like Made and Swingers, which were huge cult films, but they weren't huge films, you know, at the box office, I guess. And Will was still on Saturday Night Live and hadn't really broken out yet either. So we were able to get those guys at a bargain and at the right time. So it was so much about timing. So I think for all of us, you know, the actors included, we were all sort of in the right time for that film, and it helped us all in different ways.
I think Vince Vaughn is really brilliant at being disingenuous.
Yeah.
What do you see in him as a director? What do you like to work with about him?
Vince?
Yeah.
Honestly, and I've said this before, but Vince is hands down my favorite guy to work with in that Vince thinks, you don't really see this with actors. He's hyper intelligent. Okay, he's obviously funny, and he's a really good actor. But what you don't see a lot of times with actors is his ability to kind of view the entire movie. not just the scene he's in or not just the scene we're shooting that day. He really tracks his character and other characters. He really approaches the movie with a producerial sense, which is really impressive and helpful as the director slash producer and somebody who is looking at the big picture to have an actor coming to you and saying, you know, I just don't know if this tracks with what we're going to be shooting a month from now. And I just haven't met somebody ever like that on the acting side as far as, you know, and I'm not saying they don't have those skills, but with the actual, just wanting to address it and really his concerns, I don't know, it just blows me away. I think, Vince, if I could do every movie with Vince, I'd be happy.
I think of you as making, you know, a certain type of, like, guy movie.
Yeah.
Because you're, like, old schools about starting, like, a fraternity. Three guys in their 30s start this fraternity house, go back to their youth in a way that they can't really recapture. And, well, Starsky and Hutch is this, like, you know, male buddy thing.
Well,
and,
yeah, Starsky and Hutch is more like a male, it's a romantic comedy between two men, really.
Yeah,
what
yeah.
It, is. It really follows all the beats of a romantic comedy, but it happens to be between two men.
And your new movie is about a guy who doesn't measure up to his or the people he knows standards of, like, manhood. And he goes to this, like, self-help school to, like, become this kind of guy that he doesn't think he is. So, like, what was your youth like? Like, what was your image of manhood when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I grew up with three women, my two older sisters and my mom. My dad wasn't around, so I was really grew up in a very female household. And it's really funny because I grew up, and we were always taught to be individuals by my mom and be your own person and take care of yourself, but more so be an individual and have your own voice. And I just found it always astounding that when men go to college and your first taste of freedom really as in this country is when you go to college and you don't have your parents around, and 80% of guys' first instinct is to join a fraternity and suddenly be part of a group. The one time you're actually able to be an individual, your first instinct is to run and join a group so you could easily be labeled as something.
That's a really interesting insight.
And I really was always blown away by that because my mom always taught us the opposite. Uh-huh. And that was never the path I followed. But the people who did follow that, which was 80% of guys, always just, it was bewildering to me. So really, I made a documentary called Frat House for HBO in 1998 that explored that exact thing. What is it with man's need to belong to a group? Why are they not comfortable being labeled as themselves? You know what I mean? And I think it's a constant exploration. And it's from that, it's grown into kind of I see comedy and the awkwardness at which men relate to each other. You know, I see, you know, women and their friends, and they just seem to have such a smoother communication than guys who are so often left-footed in their communication. Even friends, you know, guy friends. There's just a left-footedness about it that I feel also lends itself to comedy. So it's kind of an amalgamation of all that stuff for me, but those are always the themes that I keep going back to. It's true.
So you made a documentary about fraternity hazings, and you made a feature film about the desire to return to fraternity life, but were you ever in one yourself?
No, I went to NYU Film School. They don't have fraternities. They barely have a campus. So we didn't, no, fraternities was a foreign thing to us, but that film ended up doing really well, and it won at the Sundance Film Festival.
The documentary.
The documentary mm-hmm. did, not Old School. And it definitely inspired Old School. But, you know, if you see, I've made three documentaries before I made my first film, and if you'd seen any of the documentaries, they all have comic undertones to them. They're not, you know, journalism, and I really never liked documentaries that felt journalistic to me. I think a documentary is all about the point of view of the director, and it's not about being a journalist. It is about inserting your point of view into it, and they all did that in a big way.
So when you were doing the documentary on fraternity hazings, you made yourself a part of the film, and you actually got hazed.
We did.
Right?
Yeah.
So what were some of the things that you had to go through in the making of the movie?
Well, we did that because, you know, the film, so many documentaries end up becoming about the journey, not the destination. Mm-hmm. And so often the journey happens to be the journey of making the film. A lot of films follow that. Actually, Michael Moore does that almost every time. And it ends up becoming the story, and it did in Frat House also because it was very difficult to get access to the fraternity houses. So in one, we got kicked out of one school halfway through the movie, and in the second school, we basically made a deal with the house that if we, and when I say we, I made that film with my partner at the time, my filmmaking partner, this guy Andrew Gerland, and we made the film together. And we made the deal that we would go through the hazing. They were very worried about the legality of what they do. And they figured, well, if we were to go through it, it would kind of take the teeth out of what's going on. And we were agreed, and we're not just standing back with a camera judging it. We're going through it. It was a weird sort of situation. But we ended up pledging the fraternity. Not obviously full on because we weren't in the school, but we went through all the things that the pledges went through.
Which was what?
Which was, I mean, just ridiculous. You say it now and it's embarrassing. At the time, it was frightening. Not really frightening, but, you know, ridiculously frightening. But, you know, they put me in a dog cage one night. One guy poured, like, tobacco spit all over me. They were shooting flames from, like, an aerosol can at us. They forced us to drink Tabasco sauce and then spit it into a cup. And then the next guy drinks from that same cup and then spit it in a cup. Again, this all goes back to me saying, what is it that guys, why would you put yourself through this to belong to a group just to ultimately be labeled and defined by, you know, three letters? It made no sense to me. And by the way, it still didn't. It's not that I did the movie and I understand it. I mean, I understand, oh, you're friends for life, and I understand, oh, you have these guys who are your buddies and your club. But I had friends in college who were still my friends, and we didn't have to go through any of that.
Now, your documentary about fraternity hazings, Frat House, was made for HBO, but it never got aired on HBO.
Yeah.
What was the story behind that?
The story there is basically we did some things that were unethical, and there's the truth again. It was just unethical filmmaking on our part, but we were a little inexperienced at the time, because what happened was you realize that it's not very easy to make a movie about rich white kids whose parents are lawyers and doctors and whatever. It's not that easy to make a documentary about them. So what ends up happening is, you know, just like I had to sign a release to be on this show, you have to hand them releases. And we noticed that when we would hand these kids releases in the daytime, they would look at the release and go, oh, all right, you know what, I'm going to fax this to my father and I'll get it back to you tomorrow. And then we would be like, oh, you know what? Actually, I gave you the wrong release. I'll give it to you. I'll give you the right one tomorrow. So we take the release back. And basically, it all came down to an issue of the kids signed releases, but most of them signed releases when they were drunk or stoned, which really was the only time they were going to sign the releases. So we had a little bit of an issue of legality of, well, you know, what sort of frame of mind were you in when you signed the release and da-da-da-da-da, because what happened was the kids just came out of the woodwork and threatened litigation with the film, and that was the only real sticking point. And I think that
a pretty major one.
Well, I guess it's a major one. I think HBO just sort of didn't want to fight the battle because there was just a lot of, you know, that coming out.
I bet you didn't do that again.
No, we never did that again. I realized that that's not the right thing to do.
So when you were making Old School, which is just a feature film,
yeah,
with the three guys who go back to fraternity life, what are some of the things you borrowed from the real story?
We borrowed some of the names. You know, funny enough, Beanie is a big part of Frat House, the documentary, and he's also Vince Vaughn's character's name. We borrowed some of the stories, like they told us, although we never shot this. They told us of the thing they had done the semester before that they ended up outlawing, where they tied bricks around the genitals of the pledge and they had to throw it off with a string that they thought wasn't long enough to hit the ground. It was ridiculous stuff, but we did take certain things from real life.
Did they really do that?
Yeah, they did that, and it was called Trust Your Brother. You had to trust that the rope was long enough to hit the ground. You know what I mean? They're standing on the roof of the house or whatever, and then there's a rope on a brick in the other end. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Oh, that sounds so horrible. Like, I just find stuff like that.
But doesn't it sound
incomprehensible?
Funny? Doesn't sound funny at all?
To me, no.
Really?
No. Yeah. Too.
Oh my.
Too weak-hearted for that. Yeah. In one of the scenes in Old School, there's a KY jelly wrestling match. Was that from real life?
I never thought I would hear you say that. Yeah, that is. Was that from real life? That was actually, but it wasn't, they didn't do it with KY jelly because it was too expensive to get that much of a quantity of KY jelly. They used this silicone, I don't remember what it was, they used some silicone-based thing that one of them got from like a machine shop, God knows what it was and how good it was for their skin, but they did use that, yeah.
What I find interesting talking to you about this is that I assume that a lot of teenage guys seeing the movie would think, yeah, and the guy who made this, he must be so cool. He must have done like stuff like this in his life. He really relates to this, and you're not that.
I know, and when I meet these kids, and I meet them all the time, their first excitement, because they're like, oh, man, the director of Olds was my favorite movie, and then there is just disappointment. And that's always a thing. It's excitement and disappointment.
So what has maintained your interest in that?
Like, you know, for me, I don't think like School for Scoundrels is necessarily following the same path as that. And I think that...
Oh, true.
Right. So I don't think it's like, you know, where we keep doing the same movie over and over. And I don't know that I have that same interest in that particular world, certainly not Fraternities. I mean, we're talking about doing an old school sequel. And it has nothing to do with Fraternities.
Talking about it, it's already on IMDb.
I know, I saw that. It is called Old School Dose. They have that right, but it's not in production.
Okay.
But we are talking about doing Old School, but it has nothing to do with Fraternities. It's really, you know, I always saw Old School, you know, we've been favorably compared to Animal House, which is a great honor. I loved Animal House, but we never really saw it as Animal House. We always saw it as City Slickers. And in City Slickers, it's like three guys in their 30s that just want to hold on to youth a little bit. And they go out into Arizona and they do this ridiculous whatever they did, cattle wrangling. You know, their
dude
cattle
ranch.
Wrangling,
yeah.
Dude ranch. And for us, it was like that idea, but these guys start a fraternity instead. So it was never really about fraternities. And the second one we're doing really has nothing to do with fraternities. It's about these three characters, because I think I just would be excited to revisit these characters and the actors, and I think we can put them in new situations that have nothing to do with that, and it'd still be really funny.
My guest is filmmaker Todd Phillips. He co-wrote and directed Road Trip, Old School, Starsky and Hutch, and the new film School for Scoundrels. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Todd Phillips. His new movie, School for Scoundrels, opens Friday. It stars Billy Bob Thornton. He also co-wrote and directed the films Old School, Starsky and Hutch, and Road Trip. Now, Ivan Reitman was one of the producers of Old School. Wasn't he one of the producers of School of Scoundrels?
No, he was a producer of Road Trip, which was my first film, and Old School, which was my second film. And he produced, obviously, Animal House.
Now, since Animal House is kind of like ground zero for a certain type of, like, you know, fraternity, wretched excess, beer and sex kind of movie, what did that do for you when you first saw it? Since your teenage and young 20s years were really different from that. Did you relate to that?
It was different. I mean, I saw Animal House when I was 10 years old.
Oh, okay.
And I saw Stripes when I was 12 years old. And I saw Blues Brothers when I was 13. And those are the movies that I grew up on. And whether, you know, even though I didn't see Animal House through the lenses of like, oh, this is what men have to go through. You know, it was just a comedy to me. And those are the movies I grew up on. So those really had obviously a big influence on kind of the stuff I make now. I mean, I would like to say I grew up on Preston Sturges and Billy Wilder. I discovered that stuff later in life and have a huge appreciation for it. But when you're 12 years old, it's Stripes and Blues Brothers that you watch over and over, and it just is the thing that really informs you. So for me, it was a thrill to meet Ivan Reitman. Funny enough, I met him at Sundance and just, you know, start working with him.
You've used music in some very interesting ways, like in Old School, when Will Ferrell's character gets married, there's this great like cover band, like five guys in their tuxedos singing a cover of Total Eclipse of the Heart, which is really funny. And then at a funeral scene, Will Ferrell sings Dust in the Wind.
Yeah, I love that part.
Tell me how you chose those songs, and also what it takes to buy the rights to actually use the songs that you want to use.
We chose... the first song was done by the Dan Band, who is friends of mine, these guys who were in Old School. The Wedding Band in Old School is actually a real band in real life called the Dan Band. And they do covers of a lot of songs. And I'm trying to remember if they did Total Eclipse of the Heart in their show, or Dan and I just sort of talked about new ones that he wanted to do. I forget the actual origin of that, but basically we came to Total Eclipse of the Heart, went into a recording studio, recorded it once, realized, boy, it might be funny if there were cursing, if there was some cursing in it. You know, it just felt suddenly like, what a weird wedding scene if the guy's just getting carried away with the song and he throws in some curse words during it. But anyway, and then Will Ferrell sings Dust in the Wind by Kansas at the funeral for Blue, a character in the movie. And the truth with that is, when we wrote the script, and this might seem a little hardcore, but the real song Will was supposed to sing was Eric Clapton's song that he wrote about his son, which I didn't know he wrote about his son, in fairness. When he put it in the script, when he goes, "If I called your name, will you see me in heaven?" That song.
Yep.
We went for the rights of that before I understood what that song was written about. We were shut down. You talk about the difficulties of getting rights of a song. So we ended up getting Kansas, Dust in the Wind, and probably it cost around $80,000.
Wow.
I think that your average...
That's really a lot.
You know, it might have been less because Will is singing it, and of course it's more... You have to get the publishing rights, which are the words, and then you have to get the performance rights, which are them performing it. Since Will performs the song... You don't have to pay for the performance rights. You just have to pay for the publishing. So it might have been like $40,000. But, I mean, we've paid for certain songs $200,000 in a movie if it just works and you want it really bad.
What did you pay that much for?
I think Simon and Garfunkel in Old School, we ended up paying $200,000. We use it when he gets shot in the neck and he falls in the pool, and it's like The Graduate, sort of, you know, a nod to The Graduate, which 90% of Old School fans don't understand anyway, so it was just a personal thing that I thought was funny. But, yeah, I think we had to pay $200,000. I don't know if that's private information, honestly.
Todd Phillips co-wrote and directed Road Trip, Old School, Starsky and Hutch, and the new film School for Scoundrels, which opens Friday. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I've come to talk with you again. Because
support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence, and from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, classic art rock from the late 70s. Ed Ward tells us about the early days of the British band Wire. John Powers reviews a film just released on DVD. He says the description makes it sound deadly, but it turns out to be a genuinely great film. And we continue our conversation with filmmaker Todd Phillips.
Play glass screen to reject my chosen target, but there's an impelling hole I can crawl through to you. I am the fly in the ointment. I can spread more disease than the fleas which nibble away at your window display. Yes, I am. Say please as you accept the next dose of disease.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with filmmaker Todd Phillips. He wrote and directed the movies Road Trip, Old School, and Starsky and Hutch. His new film, School for Scoundrels, is a comedy starring Billy Bob Thornton as a con man who runs a self-help school for losers. I want to ask you about a movie that you did not make, but almost did. And that's the Borat movie, the
yes.
Sacha Baron Cohen movie.
Yes.
And if, just for anybody who hasn't been paying attention to this, Sacha Baron Cohen is the actor who does Ali G. And one of his characters is, you know, Borat, who's from Kazakhstan and comes to the United States and thinks he's a real stud.
Like, he is.
He is a real stud, yes, and like very hip. And but he doesn't quite understand how absolutely racist and sexist he is. And one of my favorite moments for the character is when he's singing. He does things in real places where the audiences don't necessarily know what to put
That's
on.
That's right.
So he went to a bar in Texas and sang a song called Throw the Jew Down the Well So My Country Can Be Free.
Yes. Yeah, that was from the HBO show.
Yes, from the HBO show. So it was actually a very funny satire of anti-Semitism, but the people in the bar didn't necessarily know that. But anyways, he's...
That is the genius of him, you know.
Yes.
It's like people are not necessarily onto the joke, so it's very revealing and, you know.
So in the movie, which is about to come out, you were going to direct it?
What happened was I had met Sasha, and we talked about doing a Borat film. And I really approached it. I thought the way to do it was the idea of a documentary, which made sense. And really, we hit it off, and we just started making the film. The truth is, I directed the film for 3 weeks before we ended up stopping.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped really over creative differences. And it's a hard thing to say because we both wanted to make the same film. But what we realized was... And the truth is, the film is great, and Sasha is an absolute genius, and he created the character, so it's very close to him. So it's very hard to come in as an outsider and say, well, this is how we should do it. And the truth is, we started the film as a documentary filmmaker is making a documentary about Borat. And that, at its core, was incorrect. And we did not realize that at first, because the magic to Borat and what Sasha created is there is no out for the people he's interacting with. In other words, if he had done the Throw the Jew Down the Well and there was a documentary crew there as opposed to it being Borat's crew there. But you see, the movie now, how it's done correctly, is Borat's making his own, you know, documentary, okay? So, but if you suddenly put a documentary crew there, well, suddenly people are a little bit more on the spot because there are these outsiders who then they can turn to in the uncomfortable moments, which the entire film works because of those uncomfortable moments. Suddenly those moments were being stepped on because there was a documentary film crew present. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's an intermediary.
There's an intermediary, which doesn't work. So really, in Inception, which was my entire... misconception, it actually worked against what was funny about Borat. So what happened was we had to sort of stop the film and reconceive, and at that time it just was a timing thing for me, and at that time I had to move on to something because it was going to be a long time before it got going again. But the film, now done correctly, and the character, I mean, for me, what attracted to me in the first place and why Sasha is a genius is because of his fearlessness and his willing to go anywhere. And that was the only way to make the film, is the way they did it ultimately correctly.
Now, I read about one of the scenes that he did, and I don't know if this is actually in the movie or not, but I'd be really interested in hearing what it was like to be there for this. In one of the scenes that he filmed, it was at, I think, like a stadium of some sort.
And you're talking about the rodeo?
It was a rodeo.
We did that as part of the 3 weeks where I shot.
Yeah, okay.
And again, it's a perfect example of a time where... it steps on the moment a little bit because, see, my approach to it was like, one of my favorite movies growing up was Spinal Tap. So the same way Rob Reiner was making a film about Spinal Tap, this was the idea. There was a crew making a film about this guy, Borat. So in that particular scene, we were shooting in West Virginia, and it was at a rodeo, and Sasha gets up and he does his, you know, national anthem that he mangles and does wrong, and all these cowboys or 6,000 people are surrounded. It's a very tense atmosphere. And I mean, it's not as dangerous as it sounds, and nobody's life is threatened, but it was funny. But again, the moment kind of gets stepped on a little bit when they're able to turn to this crew, this American crew that's with this guy, and say, hey, what's wrong with this guy? Do you know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
So the while it still ends up in the movie because it works, but as a whole concept of the film, it was getting in the way, I think.
What I read about it is that in the national anthem, he replaces the line, and the home of the brave, with, and your home is the grave. And
I don't actually think that's right.
No, that's what I read. And the other thing I read was...
I think he actually said, and the home of the gays. I'm serious. I don't remember. It was like 2.5 years ago. But I'm pretty sure it was Home of the Gays.
And the other thing I read, and I don't know if this is true, that in introducing the national anthem, he's talking about President Bush and the war in Iraq, and he says...
Yeah, it was a very pro-Iraq speech where he says, we hope, we get to, you kill all the Iraqi men, women, and children. You know, it was very,
Yeah, he says, I hope you kill every man, woman, and child in Iraq, and may George W. Bush drink their blood.
Right.
And then he sings the national anthem, if the report is correct.
No, that is entirely correct, yeah.
And then I read that the people who were at the rodeo were so furious that what happened? The audience booed, then fired shots in the air.
No.
Rodeo organizers
Absolutely
escorted Cohen
true.
Away.
Well, this is the internet. This is the internet for you.
Things
get,
an actual
things
article.
Get built out of
yeah.
No, there were no shots fired. There was some booing. Because, I mean, honestly, the point of that is, that's people are not going to cheat. He's saying, I hope that we kill every man, woman, and child in Iraq. And people are booing that. But I mean, there were definitely no shots fired and there was no, violence. But it was fun and crazy. But, I mean, that was really what we came to the realization was there was a misconceive in the original idea because it was too easy for somebody to turn to this crew and be like, what the hell is going on? Who is this guy? Get him out of there sort of thing.
Because you make comedies and because they're with such really endearing actors, I mean, they're crazy, but you just love them, Will Ferrell and Vince Vaughn and, the Wilson brothers and stuff. People would assume, and maybe this is correct, that people have so much fun on the set because it's like such a great group of people and it's like a little repertory company. They often work together.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fun on the set, or do you have to be pretty pretty nose to the grindstone to actually get it done on time and on budget?
It's a little bit of a grind, but I do think that I read somewhere, and it's entirely true, is that you have to set the tone of a movie on the set of a movie. So if you're doing a comedy, it does have to feel pretty light and pretty fun, and you don't really bring a lot of egos to it, and there's not a lot of yelling and screaming. And I do think basically we all show up to work every day and try to make each other laugh.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, it's fun. It's not a giant party because it is still work for everybody, but it definitely is fun.
You've had the luck of writing lines and then watching great comic actors do them. Is there a favorite line that you wrote and saw that it was like so well done by the actor that it was thrilling?
Well, one of our favorite things that we wrote is... it's so silly, but the earmuffs in. And I only say that because
explain
it's
it,
used.
Explain so, it.
Well, when in old school, whenever Vince is going to say something bad, around, he always is carrying around his little 5-year-old son because he's always got to bring him to soccer practice. So whenever he's going to curse or say something bad or maybe sexually suggestive, he says earmuffs and the kid puts his hands over his ears, And it's something so random that we put in the script. And we just thought of it. It was something I grew up with or Scott grew up with. It was something we came up when we were just out one day. We were saying, well, it would be interesting if Vince is very protective of his kid. He doesn't want to, it's at his core. So anyway, that I always like because that's been referred to so many times. I've seen it referred to on SportsCenter. I've seen it used in other things. I kind of like when you write a line. So it's not so much about the actor's performance, although he did it great and sold it. But it's more of like that it's come to like mean something with people, and that's always thrilling.
So people can just say earmuffs.
Yeah, and then there's a line in old school where he says, "You're my boy, Blue," when he screams that people always shout out. But that particular line, Will Ferrell made up that line, on that moment. So it's always fun to see things that are improv by the actors or script things that end up kind of in the culture a little bit.
Todd Phillips, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
I close my eyes, only for a moment, and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before my eyes in curiosity, dust in the wind.
Will Ferrell singing Dust in the Wind in the 2003 movie Old School. Todd Phillips co-wrote and directed Old School, Starsky and Hutch, and Road Trip. His new film, School for Scoundrels, stars Billy Bob Thornton and John Heder. It opens in theaters Friday.
All we are is dust in the wind. Oh, oh, oh. You're my boy, Blue!
You're my boy.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on an art rock band from the 70s. This is Fresh Air. The British band Wire is something of an oddity, a highly influential band hardly known in its home country, and one which has broken up twice, only to come back each time as something totally different. Rock historian Ed Ward has the story of Wire's first incarnation.
When people think of art rock, they tend to think of the bombast purveyors of the 70s, the stuff that's also known as progressive rock. But sometimes, there's rock that's created as an art project. Take Wire, for example. Wire came into being at Watford Art School near London, where two students, Colin Newman and George Gill, put together a band called Overload in the middle of 1976. Shortly into its existence, Gill tried to steal another band's amp and fell down a flight of stairs with it. While he was in the hospital, the others, Newman, guitarist Bruce Gilbert, bassist Graham Lewis, and drummer Robert Gray, who called himself Robert Go-to-Bed, continued to rehearse and discovered something new happening. By the time Gil had healed, Overload had become Wire. Trying to do something completely new was in the air back then, so Wire quickly found gigs and a sympathetic producer, Mike Thorne, who brought them to the attention of EMI Records. Before long, they were the hot new news out of London, getting ready to release their first album, Pink Flag. Some of it was fairly conventional.
All right. Here it is. Again. And it's called... 1-2-X-U!
Some was less so. God save, 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 Pink Flag was just one of a number of excellent records released in 1977, but for some reason, Capitol Records in America decided to pick it up and release it. This was a period when very few British punk-like albums were available in the States, and suddenly this particular one, with its difficult-to-decipher lyrics and abrupt transitions, was all over the place. Wire weren't interested in being a punk rock band per se, although they didn't seem to mind existing within that context to some extent. Their next album, Chairs Missing, from 1978, certainly wasn't pure punk. Or anything else you could label, for that matter.
Best one behind the curtain, let it bring shake down, face one sudden, head to hand, let it move sun like scissor, chuck 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 like scissor.
Given their relationship with a major label, they had plenty of interesting technology to play with in the studio, and on Another the Letter, they were one of the first bands to use a sequencer. They were also, unfortunately, one of the first in another way.
No blind spots in the leopard's eyes can only help to jeopardize the lives of lambs that shed the cries. To life for a silver fish, eternal dust, less ticklish than the clean room a house guest wears. He lies on his side as he tries to hide. In fact, it's the earth which is nonsense, but he lies on his side as he tries to hide. In fact, it's the earth which is nonsense. A serpentine miner, a roof falls, an underliner of leaf structure, the egg timer.
Outdoor Miner sounded like a single, although it was very short, so they just edited it together twice and released it. Unfortunately, this was a period when a couple of labels were buying back copies of singles in stores, which reported to the charts. And when EMI tried it with this song, they got caught. It wasn't the band's doing, but it did stop some momentum. But Wire wasn't sitting still. Perhaps emboldened by their almost hit, they kept working on ideas for singles. Of course, their idea of singles was rather peculiar.
Watching over it before it was, as if response was based on fact. Reviving it, deciding it, it was soon there. Squared to it, face to it, it was not there.
A lot of the tracks on their last album, 154, were actually solo or duo works. Not all the band played on all the tracks. In fact, coming this far in 3 years had put Wire at each other's throats. They left EMI and broke up. That's not the end of the story by a long shot, though. The band reformed in 1985, broke up again in 1990, reformed in 2000, and dissolved again in 2004. And as of mid-2006, it appears that yet another reformation may happen. Each time Wire's appeared, it's been radically different. They've come and gone over 30 years, but one thing they're not is an oldies band.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. The music he played is from remastered reissues of Wire's first three albums from the late 70s. Coming up, a movie that's been a hit on the festival circuit and is now on DVD. John Powers has a review. This is Fresh Air. Since the fall of communism, there have been few Eastern European directors who have become as internationally known as Roman Polanski and Miloš Forman. But now from Romania comes Cristi Puiu, whose film The Death of Mr. Lazarescu premiered at Cannes in 2005 and has been winning awards ever since. It's out on DVD, and our critic-at-large John Power says that the film does something few movies ever do.
When I was in high school back in Omaha, I was taught the rudiments of logic. The thing I remember best is what I always think of as Socrates' fatal syllogism. It goes like this. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. I remember my teacher explaining how this reasoning proves that Socrates must die, then flashing a wicked smile. By the way, kids, he said, this means you. Of course, I already knew that. Abstractly, anyway. We all know that we're going to die. But given the weight of this fact, the one universal human truth, it's remarkable how few artists actually deal with the realities of dying, especially in the movies. Our films are packed with people being slaughtered in the most imaginative of ways, but they show almost no interest in the way people actually die. There's a new film just out on DVD, which is an exception. It's called The Death of Mr. Lazarescu, and it sounds pretty, well, deadly. It's a 2.5-hour-long Romanian movie that charts the death of a single man. But don't be put off. By turns moving, harrowing, and bitterly hilarious, this is one of the best movies in years. Mr. Lazarescu is a crotchety 63-year-old engineer who lives all alone in a dingy apartment in Bucharest. After having too much to drink, he feels terribly ill and calls 911. But there's been a big auto pileup that night, so the ambulance takes forever to come. And when it finally arrives, he begins his descent into a madness worthy of Kafka or Dante, which just happens to be Mr. Lazarescu's first name. Shepherded by a middle-aged ambulance attendant named Moira, he's ferried through the demented circles of the medical system, abused and tested and growing worse with each passing moment. He's living out the reality of Socrates's fatal syllogism. The Death of Mr. Lazarescu was co-written and directed by Cristi Puiu, who burst into the international spotlight when the movie premiered at Cannes last year. It's an extraordinary piece of filmmaking, but I'd be less than honest if I didn't warn you that it takes about 15 minutes to get into its pace and tone. But do keep watching, because it turns into a genuinely great film, a version of ER set in a hell where everybody moves in slow motion. As Lazarescu becomes an object shunted from place to place, one constantly yelled at for being a drunk, Puiu gives us an entire world. He fills the screen with incredibly vivid characters, none of whom are heroes or villains. There's the good-hearted Moira, for whom driving sick patients is still only a paycheck. There's Lazarescu's neighbor who thinks he's a pain, not altogether inaccurately. There's the gorgeous nurse who yaks hilariously about her sex life, and the wisecracking lab technician who looks at a CT scan and exults, "These neoplasms are real Discovery Channel stuff." But while the guy may be a joker, he also turns out to be very good at his job. At one level, Puiu has created a riveting portrait of the Romanian health system that's out of control and absurdly inhumane. It's crawling with catch-22s. But ultimately, this movie is no satire or exposé. It captures enormous truths familiar to anyone with any experience of how we die now. Both of my parents died last year, and I saw their stories in Mr. Lazarescu's. Not only does the poor man sink into the most harrowing of solitudes, he can no longer communicate what he's feeling, but he becomes something of a bit player in his own passing. He may be surrounded by medical personnel, but they're caught in their own preoccupations, starring in their own private dramas. They have families to get home to, hookups to arrange, subordinates to bully. And what makes all this so powerful is that Puiu charts Lazarescu's journey to the end of night with the clearest of eyes, never moralizing, never trying to milk our sympathy. This is simply, he suggests, the way things are. By the end, the death of Mr. Lazarescu redeems the fact of one man's humanity, while also making us feel the hard truth about the fate that awaits us all. While my death may be the most important thing in the world to me, for the world, life goes tirelessly, extravagantly, often foolishly, on.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock is our senior producer. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Bud Powell's 1949 recording of his composition, Tempus Fugit. He was born 82 years ago today.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray. Available in stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ingrid Mattson, the recently elected president of the Islamic Society of North America, the largest Muslim organization on the continent. She's the first woman, the first convert, and the first native North American elected to the position. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.